then and had dinner with him, and he's a funny guy, I'll tell you. And what amazed me is he told me his suit is almost as old as I am. And it's still in style, you know? I mean, golly, gee whiz. But he's sober. He's sober. And he has a message. So without further ado, here's Charles.
My name is Charles Lindenwood. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, family. I hope to God that you'll say a little prayer for me tonight because my voice is kind of weak. I've been exposed to something I'm not supposed to be around, and that's smoke. And I'm going to try to just speak distinctly into the microphone and see if I can't make it. You get asked a lot of questions when you go to different places. And a lady asked me tonight if I was nervous. And I said, if you ever see a speaker that's going to talk at a bunch of people like this, and they tell you, no, they're not nervous, you watch them. They'll lie about other things. I got to ask if somebody that's been sober as long as I have, I've been sober since May 15th, 1945.
All right.
Well, thank you. I hope you're still that enthusiastic when I get through talking. It thrilled me so much I don't know what I was going to say. When I first started, me and God was the only ones that knew what I was going to talk about, and I, God's the only one. Oh, somebody asked me if I remembered how it was to be drunk after all these years. I want you to know I remember my first drink. I remember that it was in Arkansas, and I was down in Fush Bottoms hunting something. And that's where we got a whole lot of our food, just hunting something. And I there was a bunch of woods right in front of me, and I saw a little wisp of smoke coming up out of those woods, and I went over there, and there was a man running a still. And he saw me about the same time I saw him, and he said, hey, come on over here, I got something for you. Well, that's what I was hunting, something. So I went over there, and he, this worm, you know, where the whiskey, white lightning, where it comes out, drip, 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 drip. He had one of them jailhouse tin cups. And it was almost full of white lightning. And he said, try this. Well, I wasn't going to disappoint a gift. So I took that still warm and chug-a-lugged it. I thought I'd never breathe again. Sound kind of like a sick goose. And I just sort of wilted. I didn't just fall down. I just, like a dish rag that you drop, you know, just... And he's standing there looking at me like, wonder how long it's going to take him to die. And I was wondering the same thing. But you know, after a while, that warm glow hit down there where it counts. And I do so. I'll just stay here and hold it. I've already forgotten where it is. I never did have a very good memory. But anyway, he was wondering how long it'd take me to die, and I was agreeing with him. I wanted to know, too. And pretty soon that warm glow hit and just run down to my toes and up to my fingertips, and I got up all by myself and start telling him how to run that still. And, you know, some kind of improvements he could make to help that out. And seemed like whiskey's had that effect on me ever since. I used to be a barroom drinker, and I'd sit next to people that was having a conversation and get in it. Like one time there's a brain surgeon on one side and a fellow that had built the Oakland Bay Bridge on the other side. And I gave them some information I expect they're still using. I like to travel. They call me the Arkansas Traveler because the judge in North Little Rock, Arkansas, suggested that I leave. And he said, now, I have known your family ever since before you was born. And he said, you come from a fine Christian home. Did you ever notice that drunks always come from a nice Christian home? I wonder if that ain't the wrong place to raise kids. I remember how it was, and I remember how I felt, and 30 minutes after that fella gave me that cup of white lightning, I had shot his mule and stole a Dominica rooster, and he's running me out across the swamp shooting at me with a 10-gauge shotgun. And I got clear home before I passed out. And I don't know how long I laid there, but my mother came out and found me. And she never had seen me looking like that before. In fact, she never had seen anybody looking like that before. And she took me in the house and gave me the only therapy she had, and that's a hot bath and a dose of castor oil and an enema. I was the cleanest drunk in Arkansas, inside and out. Well, I was just thinking, I was supposed to do something before I started to talk. I want to thank Pat Wheeler for asking me to come down here and talk. Now, remember, if I disappoint you, don't blame me, blame Pat. He's the one that caused it. And actually, no, seriously, he treated me like I was somebody. Just carried me around and bought me something to eat and I don't know what all, how nice. He introduced me to people, took me to a meeting, and there was a lot of people there, and I went in one room, and there's five other people went in there with me. Kind of a consolation deal, you know. And we talked about the ninth step. And you know I couldn't remember the ninth step because it is connected with the eighth step. And I ain't going into the steps because I always hated something in AA that was educational. And I want to thank Bill Roop. I was sitting in my room, man. I noticed that this little light on the telephone was going blink, 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 red. Well, I called up down at the desk and asked them what that was for. And they said, you have a letter down here. Well, I thought my wife had died. And maybe the house had burned down or, you know, something nice had happened. And I could collect the insurance. No. I met this fellow Roop and thanked him for sending me the letter telling me that they wasn't going to pay for no phone call. So, well, now, I'd liable to call up somebody. Appreciate things like that. I thank you, Bill, wherever you are. Because I got two more days to be here and think how many phone calls I could have made. You never know what you're going to run into at these places or who you're going to run into. Old Bob Parker's sitting over there. I hadn't seen him in a while. And I see another fellow down here, old Joe Phelan. Hadn't seen him in a while. And I love AA people. You know, I realize I'm a little weird. And, well, now, like, I was with a Catholic part of the time, and I couldn't help but let him know that I had been a Catholic. See, I went to parochial school till I was up in the second grade. And there was a nun there, teacher, named Sister Mary Catherine, and she told me I was going to hell. Well, I didn't know that alcoholism had set in, you know. And I went home and told my mother that Sister Mary Catherine had told me I was going to hell and made my mother mad. And she took me out of parochial school and put me in a public school. And there was a teacher there named Mrs. Prentice. And in 2 weeks from the time I went in that school, it was just 2 weeks to the day, she agreed with Sister Mary Catherine. And then I met another fella, Dick Bassett. He just introduced me. I don't guess any of you noticed him, did you? He's sitting around here somewhere. Anyway, we had dinner together. Enjoyed it. I had something I'd never seen before. And, of course, a lot of things we eat we've never seen before or since. I guess that wasn't worth mentioning, was it? But anyway, I had a nice dinner, and I started to tell you about remembering that first drink. You see, I talk in series. See, I don't know what I'm talking about, and you don't either. And after this is all over, somebody will say, "Did you attend that weekend thing?" You'd say, "Yes." And then they'll say, "Who spoke?" And you'll say, "Well, that first speaker was a fellow they called the Arkansas Traveler." And they'll say, "What did he talk about?" And you'll say, "Damn if I know." Well, there ain't no need asking me, because, as I said, my memory was pretty bad. I ain't going to hunt for that glass of water. It's down in there. I remember the good things about drinking. I was on the bum for a while during the Depression, and I wore T-shirts and a pair of blue jeans, and I used to sit in the bar. I'd bum a dime, you know, and then go sit in the bar and order a beer. They'd sit that beer up there with a nice foam on it, and I knew if I drank it, I'd have to leave. But as long as I had that beer sitting in front of me, well, that stool I was sitting on was mine. And that bartender couldn't 86 me. You know what 86 mean? That's about how old I am, but that means you ain't gonna get served no more. Well, what I'd do, see, I didn't have another dime to buy another beer, and I'd just leave that sit there. Well, that foam died, and the last bubble would be coming up. But in the meantime, everybody come in, I'd say, "Hello there, how are you?" You know, like I'd known them all my life. Was glad to see them. And because you know how it is in bars, people coming in, they've got things that need to be said. And they're looking for somebody to say them to, you know. And I was sitting there ready to listen. Pretty soon there'd be somebody come in, and I'd say, "Hello there, man, how you doing?" And he'd say, "I am glad to see you." He'd say, "Drink up there and we'll have us another beer." Well, I'd drink that old stale beer that'd been sitting there, and he'd tell the most outlandish story. And I'd sit there, "Why, yeah, well, you must have gone to college. Man, you know more than anybody I ever saw draw to." This fella just go on with them stories, and I'd keep ordering draw to. And after a while, I'd look in that mirror in behind the bar there. You know, you've seen that back bar mirror. And well, at that time, I was running out of teeth. And I just had two left. And I suggested the other night that we talk about teeth, and they wouldn't do it. But anyway, those two teeth, there's one up here and one down here, and they didn't match. And I kind of had to honk my jaw, you know. And I love green onion. And I don't know if you ever tried to eat a green onion with just two teeth or not. The way you do that, you take a green onion, you know, and give it a haircut, and little roots on the bottom, you pull them off and skin that tough piece of outside stuff, and then you spear it. And that splits him right down the middle. And then you give him a quarter turn and spear him again. You got four little prongs sticking up. And then you know how impatient and impetuous alcoholics are. You go... And that is just shredding. And then you gum it, and that tastes good. That juice, you know, especially if you've been drinking a few years. Well, I don't know if that was necessary. But you understand all this got something to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to ride the freight trains a lot, and I've heard of people getting kicked off of trains, and I've heard of them, a lot of things happened to them by detectives in the yards, and that never happened to me, because I would go up into the yards and find some of the railroad people and tell them where I wanted to go and ask them how's the best way to get on a train to get there. And they'd tell me. And if you ever get on the bum, well, that's the way to do it. And I never got thrown off or anything. He always told me to give me the call number on the locomotive and tell me whether it was going this way on that next wire or that way. So you'd go east or west or wherever you wanted to go to. And that wasn't because I was smart. It was because I was dumb enough to not know that they were supposed to look out for people like me. And a whole lot of our lives have been just that way. You've heard, of course, that God looks out for drunks and children and fools. Well, I fitted in all them categories, but one, I wasn't a child. But I think that Alcoholics Anonymous has given us a peculiar halo of protection. Just like there was something around us that harm couldn't enter. I remember one time I was waiting for a freight train, and there was one of my old hobo buddies come up and said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Someplace." And he said, "Well, I'm going there too." So we hopped on this side door Pullman And that door, the way you do that, you just hit it kind of in the middle here and just let your weight fall in and then crawl on inside. And I hit it and crawled down to this end of the boxcar, and he hit it and crawled down to that end of the boxcar. And the next morning when it got light, I saw there wasn't any floor in his end of the boxcar. He must not have been an alcoholic. Now, I'm not boosting you to go out and get drunk now so that the IRS won't get a hold of you. But it just seemed that way to me that God in his manner of selecting people to be blessed. Maybe that's why we say, but for the grace of God. Because you know what the word grace means. Unmerited rewards. Gifts that we did not deserve. And we've had many, all of us, no exception. And as we go on through life, sometimes something happens. Say like we have a flat and we're delayed. Or we hit all red lights and we're late getting somewhere. I feel that a lot of times if we hadn't been delayed, like a cop stopping us and giving us a ticket, if we hadn't been delayed, we might have run over somebody's pet down the road a little ways. We might even run over somebody's child. I believe that we've been under God's protection. And if you look into your rear view mirror and see from whence you came, you'll see some instances where something horrible could have happened to you, or where you escaped certain death by some unknown power. Something that happened that amazed you. I remember I went to Los Angeles. See, this judge in Little Rock called me in and he told me that he knew my family and all that stuff and said, "Now, I suggest that you go over to Mississippi or Tennessee or up to Missouri or over in Oklahoma or down in Texas or Louisiana. When you get there, just don't start doing what you're doing here in North Little Rock. And people won't know the kind of person that you have been. And you can start a new life." I said, "What? And leave home?" See, he started out this talk he gave me about, "Charlie, you've noticed that you've been out on the county farm a whole lot." And I said, "Yes, I've noticed that. I've done the time out there. I've noticed it for a long time." And he, "Well, maybe I did that time for little offenses like drunk or drunk and disorderly. Some little things that I didn't have to do with 30 or 60 or 90 days for. Because one time they arrested me for robbing two men. And we went to trial and I didn't even know what I was in jail for. And they had the trial and Judge Milton McLeese in North Little Rock was the judge. And this man pointed at me and says, 'That's the man that robbed me.' And he asked this other fellow, says, 'Is that the man that robbed you?' 'Yes.' Now, I knew the judge pretty well. We did business together. I said, Your Honor, could I say something? He said, Yes, you're in on this deal. And I said, Ask him if he knows for sure what date he is robbed. And he asked this man what date he was robbed, and he told him this date. And I said, Your Honor, I was doing 90 days on the county farm at that time, and that day hit right in the middle of it. And he asked this man, said, Are you sure that's the day you were robbed? And the man said, Well, I guess I know when I was robbed. And, you know, you don't talk that way to judges. You learn that, you know. You don't have to be a lawyer to know that either. But anyway, the judge says, Well, if you're absolutely positive, then he asks the other man, says, Do you agree with this gentleman that that's the day you were robbed? And he said, Absolutely. He said, This case is dismissed, and I want you men to be a little more careful about who you identify in the future. And he told them that his... who is that guy that works for the judge? Huh? Yeah. That's right. Thank you. You'd think I'd have learned that, wouldn't you? Many times. He said, My bailiff is called out at the county farm, and this man was doing time on the county farm, and that did hit right in the middle of that 90-day sentence. Now, that sounds like something that somebody would dream up, don't it? But wasn't that God Almighty looking out for a poor old drunk that was out of work and just trying to keep body and soul together? Well, the things that you did that you won't tell anybody but your confessor. You know, the fifth step tells us to tell things, but every one of you people here have got some secret you ain't going to tell nobody. Every one of you. Everybody's got some secrets. But in the final analysis, this program of Alcoholics Anonymous is between you and God, the God of your understanding, your God, the God that you created. You know, when you read the book and you read about getting a God, this God that you get is a God that you create. It don't say your concept of God. It says your conception. Your conception of God. You conceive a God. And that God lives within you. And that God grows if you let it grow. God just keeps getting bigger and more powerful and stronger and more real. And that's why our big book tells us about the God consciousness. We are God's children, created in His image. And the thing that makes us created in God's image is our intelligence. We, Homo sapiens, That don't mean you're sapped. That just way to put that. Them folks that wrote the Latin language didn't know much about English, I guess. We are the only creatures that God created that has the ability of choosing. We're the only creatures that have a choice. A dog is born and he acts like a dog till he dies. He's not got a choice. A bird stays in the nest and till his mother kicks him out so she can lay some more eggs. And fish and reptiles, everything that God created does not have a choice. They just got to be what they are. But you can go anywhere you want to. After this meeting is over, if I ever get through talking, you could go out and do something real nice. You could manage to do something you've been intending to do for a long time. Or you could do something real nasty. Something you've been wanting to do for a long time. We're God's children and God loves us and He's proven that love. Because He's done things for us that other people can't understand. How come, you know, we call this a disease. Alcoholism is a disease. Well, you're the best looking bunch of diseased people I ever saw. Bright eyed, you smiles, and just that in itself is a miracle. I think that's what that says up there. There was a woman never had a baby, and her husband said, "Go to the doctor and see what's wrong with you." And she come home crying. Said, "What are you crying about?" Said the doctor. Said, "If I ever had a baby, it'd be a fish." He said, "A fish?" She said, "Yes." He said, "It'd be a mackerel." Nice to have a sense of humor. They sent me to a psychiatrist one time. In fact, a lot of times. But, you know, a lot of us have got families that love us so much they have us put away. And that happened to me, and I got the nicest little psychiatrist you ever saw. He had pale blue eyes and he was kind of nervous, and he just made me know that I had to protect him. And I just wanted to do for him, you know, and he asked me questions. The damnedest questions you ever heard, like when you was a child, did you pick your nose? I said, "Yes, when it needed it." He said, "Did you wet the bed?" I say, "Still do." But I said, "Doctor, I have got news for you. If you drink about 2 quarts of beer and go to bed and you don't wake up in a puddle, there's something wrong with your kidney." Well, that got him upset, you know, and he just nervous and turned red, and I thought, "Oh Lord, I've lost him." And he is my first patient. Well, you know how it is when you're talking to somebody and they're nervous, it gets you nervous too. And one time there, something happened during the conversation, and he got awful nervous and made me nervous too. And I took a little black ball and I rubbed it around on my hand. And I just kept rubbing that little black ball around on my hand, and pretty soon he couldn't take his eyes off of it. And I was getting just calm, just doing fine. He's still nervous, and he said, "Why are you rubbing that little black ball around on your hand?" I said, "Well, you ain't the easiest man in the world to talk to today." And seemed like this kind of soothes my nerve. He said, "Do you mind if I try?" Well, I said, "Certainly." I gave him the little black ball, and he rubbed it around on his hand, and he big grin come on his face. He said, "It does. It does soothe your nerves, don't it?" I said, "Deed it do." He said, "Where did you get it?" I said, "Out of my nose." Well, that is. That is just before they sent me to the nut house. Me and him both. But I got out. He never made it. Well, I guess my time's about up. And I've enjoyed being here. I've enjoyed meeting new people. I've enjoyed eating a free meal. Sleeping in that free bed. Going home and tell my wife that they rolled out the red carpet for me, which you have done. I'm going to tell you a little story, like I hadn't been telling you a little story. There's a time in my life and your life when there was somebody that we believed in implicitly, and whatever they said we knew was the truth, and we respected that person. Usually it would have been our mother, father, or big brother, or big sister, but we believed in that person, and we'd walk along holding her hand and looking up and asking questions. And one time we were walking along and we passed a place that had an odor that was different coming out, and there was smoke coming out the door, and music, and nice music, kind of make your foot pat and make you want to dance a little, and laughter. And we asked this person that we loved and respected, what is that place back there? And that person told us, oh, you don't want to go in there. That's a tunnel of despair. You don't ever want to go in there. And we believed that person. And after a while, we grew up and we met another person about our age, and we loved that person and we believed in that person, and we were walking along and we came to just such a place again, and the smoke was coming out and the music and the laughter, and this person said, let's go in and bend the elbow a couple of times and feel better. Oh no, I can't go in there. That's a tunnel of iniquity, whatever that means. This fellow said, what are you, some new kind of nut? Well, we go in there and we'll hear a couple of jokes and laugh, and we'll hear some nice music, maybe dance a little. She, come on, man, you don't know what you're missing. So we thought that made sense, so we went in there, and sure enough, we had a couple of drinks, and it made us feel different, jovial, and we listened to a couple of jokes and told a couple ourselves and danced a little, and we wanted to go back to that place and do a little drinking and listen to some more nice music and jokes. And we kept doing that for a while. And then one time came and we blacked out. And we had trouble breathing. And our whole tunnel collapsed. And we said, oh God, help me. There we were, the lights were on, and we could see down at the end of the tunnel. We could see light down at the end of the tunnel. And we knew instinctively that if we walked straight toward that light, we'd be free. We'd be out in the open. But we saw some doors on either side of that tunnel. It might be a shortcut, a softer, easier way. And we went in one of these doors, and somebody just beat the hell out of us and left us laying there bleeding. And we said, oh God, help me. There we were, back out in the tunnel again, and there was more doors. We could see the light down at the end of the tunnel, but it was a long ways down this straight, broad path. And we went in another one of these tunnels in the doors, and we were covered with spider webs, spiders. And we knew that they were not real, but they were more real than real. And we didn't know we had DTs. We didn't know what delirium tremens were. And we said, oh God, help me. And we went on, and there was other doors and other doors and other doors. A judge was standing in one of them behind the bench, or at the bench. And he denied us the right to see our loved ones and gave us a little writ that meant that we were denied the right to see somebody or a family, our family, that we loved with all our soul. We went on, and there was more doors and more doors, and finally we came to a door that didn't say anything. It just had a skull and some crossbones on it, and it said poison. And we knew if we went in that door, that would be final. That would be death. So we didn't go in that door. We just said, God, help me. And somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous came and sat down beside you and took your damp, clammy hand in one of his dry, strong hands and put his arm around your trembling shoulder and said, come, go with me, and we'll do this together. And he didn't leave. He's still here. And you're still here, out in the light, no problem. Faith in a power greater than yourself. And that's a beautiful ending to this story. And I hate to tell you that some of you people are going to hear that music again. And some of you people are going to go in to hear a few more jokes and have a few drinks, bend the elbow a little. And there's not a person in here that says, I'm one of them, because you don't believe that you'll ever take another drink as long as you live. You believe you're as good an AA as anybody else. And I do too. And I believe you're worth saving. I believe that God in His infinite wisdom has selected you. And all you have to do is believe. All you have to do is do what you know you're capable of doing. And I hope that you and I will meet again under these same circumstances, and you'll be sober, and I will too. God bless you.